Interview with Donald Stone, December 3rd, 2009, in Scarsdale, New York, by Kenneth Durr.
Excellent. Well, let's start with the backstory. And I noticed that you were in the military and actually served in World War II. Is that
yes,
right?
I did.
Army?
I came from a family where my father enlisted in the Army when he was a boy. He graduated, was a poor boy from North Adams, Massachusetts, and he got a scholarship at Williams College, and he volunteered in World War I, where he was he went to Camp Devon, and they put him in Officers Candidate School, and he, instead of coming out as a second lieutenant, he came out as a first lieutenant. And came from a poor family in North Adams, and he wrote letters to his mother. He had friend mail, so she never knew he went overseas. And he was in the infantry in World War I, and in World War II, he enlisted again, and he didn't have the health to get in what he wanted, but he ended up in naval officer procurement. He was a lieutenant commander in Washington, in New York. He was the only, I went and had lunch with him before I went overseas one morning, and he's having lunch with all these admirals, and he had different, he had Army service medals on his chest where the other guys didn't know what the hell they were at first. And then I enlisted, I went to Deerfield Academy, mm-hmm. and I graduated in 42 and went to Williams that summer. It was the first time they had people going to college in the summertime, and I enlisted in that fall and got my father's permission, and as did my brothers. My younger brother went into the Marines doing early on. My older brother went into the Air Force and won 8 air medals and Distinguished Flying Cross. He was the lead bombardier at Iwo Jima. And so we were in, and I had 2 stepbrothers, one who was in the Navy in the North Atlantic during that terrible time when the German submarines were picking everybody off, and he ended up in the Pacific. And the other one was a Marine. And three of them were at Vietnam at the same time, where they have the flag.
Mount Suribachi.
In the island that where the Marines went in, and you see 3 guys holding the
flag. Yeah, Iwo Jima.
Iwo Jima. Yeah. 3 of them were Iwo Jima at the same time, and never knew until the war was over. One was on a destroyer, one was flown over, and one. So I enlisted, and I went into I tried to get in the Air Force, and I didn't have good enough eyesight. They said I couldn't fly, but I could be an aerial gunner. I didn't figure that one out. And then I transferred from there into something which I thought was called the ASTP, the Army Specialized Training Program, which I thought was going to put me in the intelligence and do something overseas. Mm-hmm. And the intelligent thing they did was at the battle, about the time of the Battle of the Bulge, I was when they transferred me and a lot of others to, I went to the 1263rd Combat Engineer Battalion, and we were all sent over for the Bulge.
Okay.
So for their wisdom. I got in that program because I was with people who spoke Italian, French, German, and I didn't speak schoolboy French. And I passed a test where I got a perfect score on a fictitious language test, so they assumed I knew something. I didn't know anything. And after the war, I was walking in Paris. A fella came up to me. He said, "Hey, Stoney, how you doing?" And this fella had been in the FBI, and he had parachuted into Paris during the war and spoke fluent French, and there he was a civilian, but he wasn't a civilian. And that was the organization I tried to be part of, but ended up in the combat engineers. I was at the Battle of the Bulge. It was the first time I ever heard a gun go off in anger. And I ended up going through Holland with British 2nd Armored Division, and then I ended up crossing the Elbe River at the end of the war with the 82nd Airborne. And we were the northernmost troops, Allied troops, in Europe. And I went through three, I think, concentration camps, first guys through. So I had an exposure there, and I, after the war, I was in occupation, and I wanted to come back. I had enough points to come back, but I didn't feel like coming back right away. I eventually ended up coming back in the fall of 46, and I called a fellow who had been a good friend of mine. I didn't know if he's alive or not. I hadn't seen my family or brothers or anything for 3 years. And then I found it very difficult to be back in New York. My dad lived in New York then. He was on Wall Street, and he had not he resigned from his firm, and then he went back, and I went back to college, and went back that spring, summer. I went back in March, and then I went around the clock again, and then I graduated in the fall of 47.
Okay, and you got into the bond business, right?
Well, I was, yes. I worked with my father, who has an Azealand company, and I became a bond trader.
What was the company?
Azeel & Company.
Okay.
And my dad was this poor boy from North Adams, Mass, who got a scholarship at Williams. He loved Williams College, and he eventually became a lifetime trustee of Williams, which he was the poor boy from North Adams who made it. He was a governor of the New York Stock Exchange early on. And he passed on to my brothers and me. Our mother was sick. She had what they called a nervous breakdown in those days. So we were brought up. I was brought up differently than we didn't have a mother. She was ill, and later on we learned it probably was schizophrenia, but they didn't know it in those days.
Yeah. So did you think early that you wanted to get onto the stock exchange because of this exposure through your father?
Well, I was thinking of leaving Wall Street, frankly. I didn't like the bond trading. I understood it. I had worked on the floor. I knew the action was on the floor. And I didn't want to end up in his firm, because I had said to him, if I'm successful, it'll be because I'm your son, and I don't want that. So he bought a seat on the exchange for $53,000, and he said, you owe the money to your brothers. And it took me, so I owed them each a third of the 53. It took me many years to pay it off, but I did as soon as I could. And I started out as a $2 broker on the floor, where I made a living. I figured what I ought to do is have something that other people didn't do. And so I started doing arbitrage on the floor of convertible preferreds. And in those days, financing was done by rights. And, say, American Telephone would have an offering, a rights offering, to raise capital. You'd buy the rights, you'd sell the stock short, and make the spread. And there were, when I started doing that, there were very few people doing any of that stuff.
Okay, so you went from being a $2 broker to doing the arbitrage.
No, that's what I did as a $2 broker.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Too. But then I got involved. Found that I could make more money doing the arbitrage, but getting a commission on both sides. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and I realized that I never left the floor from the time. My best days were Saturdays, because guys would go off to play the football games and so on, and I'd pick up commission orders at that time. Saturday was my big day, and I could get a lot more $2 business then, and of course, when you think back on it, the volume was something like 300,000 shares, and a big order would be 500 shares, 1,000 shares, wow. Mm-hmm. And there was fixed commissions, obviously, then.
Right.
And I knew how lucky I was, but having been on the floor for a while, I realized that the best business there was the specialist business.
Why?
Because the orders were brought to you. I ended up, say, the specialist in Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola. Wherever you wanted to buy Johnson & Johnson or Celcon, there was one spot, and that was where we were.
Right.
And so I knew that was a good thing to do, and I was asked by some guys who had an existing joint account, would I like to join them? And I said yes. At the same time, I was asked by E.H. Stern and Company, Eddie Stern and Bunny Lasker, if I'd like to join them. Well, I didn't have any capital, and I knew you needed capital. I think I had $30,000, and I owed my brothers. And so I decided if I joined E.H. Stern & Company, which they asked me to do, and I said, my contribution will be what I make as a specialist, that's how I can help. But I knew that E.H. Stern, I think, was the richest trader on the exchange. He had capital, and that was vitally important to my being a specialist. They didn't ask me for that, but then when they found that out, they thought that was great. So that they'd be, and eventually I ended up running that specialist business.
So ordinarily a specialist, to get into the business, you needed to have money that you could put up?
No, but not necessarily. A lot of the people who became specialists were former clerks of the specialists.
Okay.
And they'd bring them out in front. I did that.
Okay.
I trained a whole bunch of guys who I'd get a seat for them, lease a seat for them, had taught them how to specialize. That's what I did. And I did it a little differently than others. I eventually ended up running that specialist unit.
Right.
And then I merged with some of the guys in that unit into our firm.
So you're working with E.H. Stern & Company.
Yes, that's right. And I was the lowest lowest animal on the totem pole.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to realize that I was terribly fortunate to be a specialist. And I worked very hard. I felt I tried to figure out how to do it differently than some. And what I did when Eddie Stern died and Bunny Lasker and I changed the name of the firm to Lasker, Stone & Stern, I realized that capital was vital to vital for the running of a good specialist operation. Your job is to maintain a market under all conditions, and the companies are very concerned when the market goes down how you participate. They aren't too interested how you participate on the way up, but they wanted you to be there on the way down.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very conscious also of my relationship with the companies in which I was registered. And before I was done, it was over 100 companies because I merged the firm with Merrill Lynch.
Right.
That's down the road. As I was doing the specializing, I realized I could create capital if I was short the market. In other words, I didn't have to, I was credited, not debited, and so I would try to go home every night with a short position in dollars. Not that I thought the stocks should be shorted or anything, I just wanted to have a balance. So I would, the market originally closed at 3 o'clock and then closed at 3:30 and then closed at 4 o'clock. I would, later in the, an hour before the close, and I always was very conscious of doing, I graded the specialists not how they made money, but how they lost it. I was very concerned that they didn't let losses run. And I thought that that was a good trader was one who would, he's a trader, he's not an investor, that he would take a loss. And I tried to teach them from me. I knew that they thought the more money they made the firm, the more they'd get paid. That is a factor, but I evaluated the less money they lost as a very more important.
Mm-hmm.
In a bull market, you buy something and it's going to go, if it goes up, and we had plenty of bull markets,
yeah.
But also stocks each have different qualities, and I was always conscious of the illiquidity of the market outside of our own trading. I mean, the real illiquidity of the market. And I knew that the corporations marked you well as how you participated in a declining market or their stock declining. And I kept close contact with the companies. I personally did it in a great number of our companies and then tried to teach guys how to, what they wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. And any aberration in the trading of the stocks, be sure to call them at the close and tell them what happened, who's doing what.
It's your job to buy when it's going down.
It sure is. And you obviously have to supply stock when it was going up.
Right.
I thought one time, for a specific example, I thought it would be right for Buffett to list. I became very active in the exchange. I was a floor official, then a floor governor, and then a director, and then vice chairman. And I was a vice chairman twice, which I guess is the only one who was, that you had a six-year term and then you're out. Well, I guess I didn't learn how to do it, so they brought me back. And I did it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I was awfully aware. I was very aware of when companies complained around the exchange. And you could go in and I'd speak to the, or have governors going in to speak to the individual and see what was happening and what they were doing and talk them into participating maybe more than they had been. And in my own case, in being short the stock on an ongoing basis, great stocks, we had... I had Reynolds Tobacco, Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson before long. I eventually had U.S. Steel, Blockbuster, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, which split into Lowe's Theaters. That's how I got to know Larry Tisch very well. We had Blockbuster. We had Enron. I mentioned U.S. Steel. We had the Chemical Bank, which became Manufacturers Trust, which became eventually J.P. Morgan. And so we had a wide spectrum, Celanese, say Regis Paper, Standard Packaging. I can't remember them all.
How many were you handling back in the 50s when you were younger? How many of those would you handle?
I would probably handle one or two.
Okay.
And I'd handle Johnson & Johnson. I got very close to the company. I cared a lot about those people were terrific with me. Mm-hmm. And during the Tylenol crisis, at the end of it, Jim Burke called me up and said, would I have lunch with him? I said, sure. He said, I'm coming down to see you. And he did. And I thought he was going to bring his son down or something to see the exchange. But he said, I came down to thank you for what you did for us during the Tylenol. That was a hell of a nice thing to do. Obviously, I remember when I left there, when I stopped, I merged later with, I sold the business to Merrill Lynch, and I ran there, merged the two units. And before I did that, I called the chairman of all the companies that we were specializing in and told them what was happening and what I thought was very good for their company, because they had permanent capital. They had the biggest and best public firm in Wall Street, and it would be good for the company to have, which I would tell the CEOs, you have here a top company who will, whose customers will get to know your company better than they would have if they weren't there, I hope and think. Mm-hmm. But more important, you have permanent capital there, right, which will have longevity. Whatever happens with a specialist firm, it'll be good for you.
Yeah.
And at Johnson, it was at Coca-Cola, I guess, Rosetta said to me, Donnie, if it's good for you, it's good for us. And the same thing, I called Don Keough, he was overseas. If it's good for you, it's good for us. And that was, at a Johnson & Johnson, they were terrific. And when I retired, they gave me a party down there with the executive board.
So it paid to stay in close touch with the companies you were with.
It did. And then I had other people who were the head of the companies who would say, every time you want to see a block of stock, kind of, let me know, Don, let me know. Mm-hmm. And by the way, what's your position? And he was always wondering, what was my position? What's my position? After the crash, I wonder if they crashed, I lost over $1.5 million in his stock. And he had always said...
Which crash were we talking about?
Pardon me?
The recent one or the 87? Or?
No, back in 87.
Okay.
And that was a lot of money to me and to our firm. It was the most we lost in any stock. And he had said to me, anytime you see a block of stock, call me. I called him 3 times. Those 2 days, and I'd offer him stock a point or a point and a half below the last sale. He said, who's the seller? I said, I am. I'm trying to oh, it's nice of you to call me, Don. I'm not interested. But that was, you know, you got to know your players.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one time I said to him, would you have lunch with me? He came down and I said, I want to show you something. The exchange evaluates each specialist, shows how much stock they bought and what sort of a range, how it compares with other units, that same price stock with the same capitalization. And I said, I want to show you what we've done for you over the years. And obviously I was showing him a very good picture, and I said, and I've arranged something that's going to make you very happy. He said, what's that? I said, you're going to get a lovely new specialist, someone you'll get along with very well, and you won't have the problem to have to call him and ask him daily like you do with me how much I bought and what my position is, and they're much wealthier than we are, and you'll do much better.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I didn't want to do that. I said, look, you've been on my can for the last 10 years, and I've responded to you on a daily basis. Whenever you call, I'm there and I tell you what's going on. And I and he said, no, I don't want to leave. And I said, okay, well then I don't want to hear from you again.
Gave him no choice.
Well, you had all kinds of people.
Yeah.
There were very few like this guy. But
well, you were paying close attention to the companies you were serving here.
Yes, sir.
When did you start paying close attention to the exchange and really getting tied in to
That's a good question. I was asked. The exchange has a lot of pecking orders. First, you become a floor official, and then you become a governor. We had 16 governors.
What does a floor official do?
A floor official, we had 72 floor officials who were watching all the time, trading all around the floor, not trading, are positioned around the floor, and if there's an imbalance in a stock, they're over there to see what's going on, what they can do. They also want to make sure that the rules are observed.
Hmm.
And if there's an imbalance and it's going to, you have to get a floor official's permission to do, or we, in those days, you have to get a floor official's permission.
Is this the kind of thing that the regulators took over?
No, nobody. That's one of the problems I want to talk to you about.
Okay, great.
And we had the floor officials, and then over them we had governors.
Mm-hmm.
There were 16 governors. It was an honor to be a floor official. It was an honor to be a governor. And the governors were all around the floor, and they had more clout than a floor official in determining openings. If anything went wrong, before long, the floor officials would bring in a floor governor. And then there were above them, there were four directors. And I was one of those directors. And the directors, we divided up the exchange, areas in the exchange, but anything to do with. And we met for, we'd meet every week for lunch to discuss what was happening, what we could see. We also had something called the Market Performance Committee. And on the Market Performance Committee were the floor governors. And upstairs governors were on that committee.
Is this the Board of Governors?
No. Okay. It was a Board of Governors. It was called the Market Performance Committee.
Okay.
But then after that, there was the directors of the exchange, four of us from the floor. And there was one of the four would be vice chairman. And then there would be a vice chairman from the industry. I had as vice chairman with me Bill Schreier from Merrill Lynch. I had as a vice chairman with me George. I don't think of his name. I'm terrible on names. This man was chairman of First of Boston, George Shin. And I had with me John Goodfriend, chairman of Bear Stearns, Solomon Brothers, pardon me.
Right.
Solomon Brothers. And I had a fellow who was the chairman of Goldman Sachs. Excuse me, Goldman Sachs wouldn't take the job. Donaldson Lufkin, and the chairman of Phil, chairman who became the chairman of Morgan Stanley.
Be okay if I close that door since
yes,
the
please.
Vacuum cleaners are in.
I don't blame you. I can ask him to go where else.
Oh no, that's okay. This will make things easier on the transcriptionist.
Right.
All right. Well, you're moving up over time, but your first involvement would have been as a floor official, I guess, getting into.
That's correct. And I was asked to be a director early on, and I came up to my partners and said they've asked me to be a director, And they said, well, we don't think you should get it, because if you get it, one of us can. And so I had the determination to. So I came back. I didn't have any money, and I didn't want to be part of that firm. So I turned it down, and I won't go into it. That's what happened. And then they came back to me later in the game.
Bunny Lasker must have been moving up as well.
Well, he was the one. He was my partner.
Yeah.
And he wanted it.
Okay.
And so I went to the nominating committee and suggested him at his request. And
okay.
He went up.
Yeah. You got plenty of chances later on anyway.
Yes, I did.
How about...
And I was probably better off... The exchange was probably better off that I didn't get it then, because I had a lot more experience by then.
Mm-hmm. Some big policy issues, and this would have been in the early 50s, and this might have been too early for you to worry about, but there was a lot of discussion of off-floor trading of exchange.
I spent a lot of time in Washington. I was the fellow who was on all four market structure committees. So I knew that very well.
Did you start with the institutional investors? Was that the first one?
The first institutional investor study.
What was driving that? Why was that one started?
Well, there was, as I remember it, John Whitehead, I believe, was the chairman of that committee. And it was, there was rumblings about the institutions and their relationship with the investment banks, and it ended up, if I remember correctly, as a study of floor trading. They deflected it. But
who's they?
Pardon me?
Who's they that deflected it?
I think the investment bankers.
Okay.
Whatever.
This leads to the issue of fixed commission rates, right?
Not yet. That was a little later.
Okay.
That was a little later.
Because I know the institutions are trading very large blocks of shares.
Correct.
And they're wondering why they have to pay these.
Right. And that's all. Oh, it's always money on every one of these things, as you know, as to why we're all down at the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
And it's turf for the people who are running the thing, like the New York Stock Exchange. Was the biggest market in the world, and there was always people who were in the over-the-counter market, Gordon Macklin, those fellas all wanted to trade the listed stocks,
mm-hmm.
and there were block traders were trading listed stocks. There was a whole network of people, and the exchange was a regulator, a big regulator, and the member firms had to hire legal help to make sure they complied. They had the NASD looking at them, they had the SEC looking at them, and the New York Stock Exchange looking at them. And oh joy of joys, if you didn't have that, you'd save a lot of money, and you'd make a lot more money. It's the way I looked at it. And over a period of years, I was on all these committees, and I started out with the normal bias that the New York Stock Exchange is a great regulator, and we don't need another regulator.
Mm-hmm.
But I came away with a knowledge that the SEC was the best thing. That SEC, that time, was a great regulator. They kept everybody's toes to the fire and on the line to see that they were doing it correctly. And they were the ones that, and I think they were the, I've learned to greatly respect what they were doing, and they had very bright people working at the SEC. I got to know the staff very well because I was down there all those years.
And this was in the 70s when you were on these...
Yes.
These,
and then on up, I was on the National Advisory Board. I was on I forget all the committees.
Right, there was the yearly committee in the early 70s.
I was on the yearly committee, and I was on
the National Market Advisory Board.
And another one.
Later in the
70s. I forget which one it was. Market structure or something. But I was on all of them, and I got to know the staff well. And I realized the commissioners, bless their hearts, were there for a short period of time. But the staff was highly knowledgeable, or wanted to be highly knowledgeable, and I thought it was my job to see that they were. Hmm. And John Phelan was very good at that. He also felt that... and I felt that, and then I got to know the commissioners and the chairman being much more powerful than the commissioners each one having their own interests. And over a period of time, we figured out, John really did this, that academia didn't know about the, didn't really, it was much easier to attack the exchange than to understand what was happening. And we decided, he decided to have a institutional, have an advisory committee, academic people coming into the exchange and learning about it. Hmm. And Bob Rubin and I both went to and were taught over at NYU. Gus Levy had a program, and one time he asked us to come over and take over for him, and I talked about the exchange. Bob talked about arbitrage. And then I, for 5 years, had my own I taught at NYU Business School for 5 years, and it was more educational for me than it was for the kids, although they weren't kids, because most of the people weren't in NYU. They came in from the banks and right. brokerage firms and right. so on. And it was a great experience, and then I got too busy doing stock exchange stuff. I couldn't do it. But at that time, Don Whedon was a very effective voice for the third market. He and I became friends. I was friendly with his brother, which I am with both of them today. Don and I could sit across the table from each other in Indian Russell, but at the end of the day, we'd go out and play tennis, and we're friends,
yeah,
and are friends to this day. And he was a passionate, successful David against the Goliaths of the exchange, and he did very well. And the net is that what he fought for exists today, and the exchange doesn't exist today,
right.
like I knew it.
Right.
And that's something I'd like to talk about a little bit.
Absolutely. You know, you worked with him on the National Market Advisory Board, and you're really looking at the idea of what the future market should look like, sort of
right.
like you talk about academics sort of wanting to invent something brand new.
That's correct.
Work with the exchange.
And the SEC had a bias towards supporting competition, and we put into place the intermarket trading system, where you could look on the screen and you'd see the Pacific Coast Exchange, the Chicago Exchange, and could, through electronics, trade if their market was better.
Mm-hmm.
You could trade with them. There were only a couple of people in the system who really competed with New York. One was Bill Lupi, and I think Jean will get that.
Okay.
I know she will.
Right.
She got it. Good.
But that was a transitional period, and it was very interesting, and they wanted to put in a CLOB, a consolidated limit order book, and that never happened. But the exchange kept upgrading its electronics, and John was the great Phelan was the one who really got that going, and then we ended with Dot and Super Dot, and the volume was such that we couldn't exist without it.
Right. And how did that affect the way specialists, for example, were doing their job?
Well, it meant that you had to have very good clerks behind you to be able to handle the volume as it came in. And when the clerks made a mistake, which they did on occasion, and they put the overlooked orders or put things on the buy side when they should have been the sell side, we had to stand up to it. And so it could cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars if they didn't do it right. And
when you say we had to stand up to it, you had to make good on them.
Absolutely.
Mistake. Yeah. Okay.
And did.
Okay.
Over a period of time, I got such respect for the system. I was the usher for people who would come in from the outside, whether I had some wonderful people from Washington, and I remember a general who defended Stalingrad came in from Russia, and he came in with, I had Khrushchev and Gorbachev, you'd get to see them all, and I said to the interpreter, tell the general that a Russian soldier saved my life, and I told him a war story, and all of a sudden he gives me a great big hug, and then we're buddies. That I would always start my spiel with people who came to the market is, I am the most regulated businessman in the world. Every transaction I make is real time in a computer, and their computer's watching the computer, and their humans watching the computer. And there's an audit trail on everything I do, real time. And it makes imperfect people like me level. None of us are perfect. But you can't make a mistake here because you're being watched. Yeah. And I say, that's good. It forces this market to be a very valuable public market.
Was it always the case?
Pardon me?
Was that always the case even in the 50s? Or did
we didn't have the electronics.
Right.
We didn't have the electronics, but we got it. I guess that was in the 80s.
Yeah. Were there manual audit trails or things like that, though, in the 60s or 70s?
But not like this.
Not nearly as effective.
You know, you'd have to go backwards. Hell, we used to write, in the early days, Ken, we used to write the orders by pen or pencil into a paper book. Mm-hmm. And that was the audit trail, the book. And now everything was in computers. And the volume kept increasing, and the efficacy of the electronic book had to be upgraded, One of the places I think we fell down, we had it in our crowds always reporters. They were exchange employees, and they put on a Mark Sense card the transactions. Mm-hmm. And somewhere, I thought it was a mistake to lose them, because I thought it was almost a little regulatory arm that the transactions, they couldn't keep up with it. A human couldn't keep up with it. Mm-hmm. So it had to be done by the clerk, and the clerks had to get the orders in. Then turn to the specialists and say, you've got 12,000 to buy, 6,000 to sell, and the price, and you trade. Mm-hmm. It was good for the exchange to have, I thought, those reporters, but it put the burden of reporting accuracy on the specialist himself. And I'm not saying that people didn't do it well. Some people did it better than others. But the volume got humongous. Mm-hmm. And it was important that the exchange continue to update its systems. As I say, when I was first down there, 300,000 shares. 1,000 shares. Ooh, man, you got an order.
Right. I mean, things were really changing in the 60s. You could see it happening, I'm
right.
sure.
And I was there in the 50s.
Yeah. Was there any sense that, it got so bad in the 60s, you had your back office?
Right.
Was there any sense that
I was on
coming?
Every one of those damn committees, too.
Really? What did you do? What was the discussion like on those committees?
Well, let me tell you about the Market Performance Committee, for example. Yeah. The Market Performance Committee met every Wednesday, and it had some traders from institutions as well as block traders. And we would talk about what had happened that week, any problems people ran into. I'd hold when the committee first met in the early part of the year, I would say, we're going to have an executive committee meeting here. The staff would come in and sit there. But then the members were the regulators more than the staff. And I said, everybody's going to get 3 minutes to talk. Figure out what we ought to do in the coming year to make this a better market. And we took down what that was, and then we would vote on it, what was in terms of what should be done in priority. Mm-hmm. And we would do it. And when they come up from the floor, and I learned to get 100% presence at the meeting, I'd call the meeting at 4:15 if the market closed at 4, and you're out of here mid-sentence at 5:30. But it's going to be run like that, mm-hmm. and so people came. And they liked the opportunity to tell you what went wrong on the desk upstairs. The specialist did that, or we should have been doing this, or no one told me. And it was real self-regulation.
So members of this, did you draw members of this committee from all over the place, different functions?
Well, they worked, they were the floor governors.
Okay.
And the floor governors were chosen by the directors, and also we had elections on the floor, people who wanted those people to do floor governors. So it was, oddly enough, democratic.
And so they had their ear to the ground.
You bet.
And they
were dedicated. And that was terrific. I left leaping ahead. I left the floor, but pertinent to this, I sold my business to Merrill Lynch in 91, and I ran their business for 5 years, of the amalgamated business. And I came back when the exchange, when Grasso left, and I knew Grasso from the days when he was head of contacting the member firms and trying to bring in business, which he was very good at. Bringing in members,
right?
And stock list. It was kind of stock list, and I knew him that long. And as time went on, and then when Dick left, and the exchange changed dramatically, and brought in John Reed, I think it was Paulson who picked Reed. When Reed didn't make the cut at
right.
Citibank, Sandy got wild, beat him, and then he came in for $1 a year, and they put me back on the board then. with three other guys. And on that board at the time were Paulson and Stan O'Neill from Merrill Lynch and the head of Morgan Stanley. Who's now the head of Morgan Stanley?
We'll get it.
And also, no, he was the head of another firm that was Phil, I couldn't remember before then, was the head of Morgan Stanley. Phil Purcell. Mm-hmm. Phil Purcell. And when that was an interesting board, there were the public governors who were interested in the public, and then there's the industry people. And at that time, I had said to John Reed, how's the Market Performance Committee doing? He said, what? I said, the Market Performance Committee. I turned to one of the former, I think, Jimmy Jake. I said, how about the form? What's it doing? Oh, they met five times last year under Grasso. Mm-hmm. So they lost their teeth.
Hmm. There wasn't the level of input from the people down below.
Floor.
One of the questions that gets to is, you know, you sort of describe a kind of a self-governing exchange.
That's what it was.
The decisions are being made, you know, through these democratic channels. During your time, you saw a lot of different chairmen and different styles, I imagine.
Yes,
how much could they move the exchange? How much could they change direction?
Well, it depended who they were. The one who moved the change the most was John Phelan, because he had worked on the exchange as a specialist, and he knew more about it than, say, Mill Batten, who came in from J.C. Penney. And John understood it, and John was replaced by Bill Donaldson, and Bill Donaldson was an industry fella, but he didn't know the exchange as well as John Phelan, and Dick Grasso certainly knew the exchange very well. So when Mill Batten was there, he relied on John Phelan, and Bill Donaldson relied a lot on Dick Grasso.
Right.
And the interim period, all the time, the Market Performance Committee had a lot to do. John Phelan was president of the exchange under Batten, so he had the protection of seeing that the floor worked correctly and the exchange worked correctly under his aegis.
Unfixing commission rates. We didn't talk about that. We talked about all the committees in the 70s.
Right.
And, of course, that was the big to-do.
Right.
What was the effect from your perspective, from the floor's perspective?
Well, it was inevitable that with competition, like it was, that rates should come down. The only mistake in the coming down of rates, in my opinion, is when they went to paint trading in pennies. Because in trading in pennies, you've lost the transparency of the market. You don't know. You couldn't see the market. In those days, you could see. Well, of course, you can't see the market anyway anymore because there's these deep pools, and there is no regulation anymore. One of the things that and the rates came down. And the industry learned how to live with the rates coming down, and they made their money trading in derivatives.
Right.
Which is something I'd like to talk about quickly, mm-hmm. if I could.
Sure.
That it concerns me that the market is unregulated today. I don't think it's in the public interest today. The transparency of the market doesn't exist.
The derivatives market.
With derivatives and people trading, exchange only does about 20 or 18% of the listed trading volume today. Before, it was all out there for everybody to see. Now, you have to go to the major firms to, you see up there the bid and offer, but you don't.
Right.
There are pennies. They disclose, they hide what the real market is. And the real market isn't on the floor of the exchange anymore. It's fragmented around the country, and things are happening in fractions of seconds as orders are diced, and computers can go into the system and play games, finding out, trading against the bid, raise it a penny, raise it a penny, the other guy comes up, raise it a penny, raise it a penny. Then they, if someone's working an order, people can trade against that order very clearly today. And do. I have a friend who's a big trader, big money manager, who said, I had a small order, $25 million, and the it cost me $50,000 to execute it because they're playing the slicing game, and before I could get the order executed, I got executed. And it's what bothers me is, I'll do one thing that really bothers me, is the short selling rule, which had great effect on the decline of AIG, Fannie Mae, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and nearly Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, whom they miraculously became banks overnight, mm-hmm. so you couldn't get them. And Merrill Lynch they nearly did Merrill Lynch. And I wonder, how does that happen? Where did all that selling come from? Did it come from hedge funds? Did it come from trading desks? How could they sell short? Well, the short selling rule when I was around was a plus tick or a zero plus tick. And you have to borrow stock. Even today, the rule says you have to borrow stock if you sell it short.
Mm-hmm.
There's been absolutely zero regulation to find out who borrowed the stock.
Okay.
How did they get all that Bear Stearns stock? Do you think that the fellows who ran Bear Stearns would lend them the stock, who had the big blocks of stock? Of course they wouldn't.
Now, something
it was naked selling illegally without borrowing stock.
Mm-hmm.
Have the regulators done anything about it? No.
Hmm.
And the exchange that didn't take place on the exchange,
right?
Elsewhere.
So formerly, that kind of thing would have showed up.
It would have showed up immediately, mm-hmm. and it wouldn't have been done because they wouldn't dare do it. But there, I have a strong gut feeling, having lived in markets as long as I have, and understanding the short side very well, that there was no short selling rule. And I might add, there's none now. 9 months ago, the SEC started talking about a short selling rule, and they had it out for a 90-day commentary period. Mm-hmm. There's no short-selling rule now, and there's nobody checking if they're borrowing stock when they do it. Well, what the hell? There's no reason to. The market acts so well. But it won't. And these fellas still have the opportunity, and if I read the papers well, there were a group of people who came out saying there's no need for a short-selling rule now, and obviously the SEC has done absolutely nothing about it. And I believe that market structure is vitally important as green leaves that everybody is seeing, the green that's growing, and the real estate market is coming back. Well, maybe it's going to be 10 or 11, but it'll come back. And our system is set up just like it was before to have this happen again, because the short sellers are the ones who really made a great deal of money and knocked the market off. Hmm. I'm sure there's some that did it very honorably, but when the faucet got turned on, it'd be very interesting to see who who did what.
But that has and that's very important with the fact that the exchange is essentially so decentralized at this point.
The exchange is just another trading system. Yeah. It's not a regulator like it used to be.
Well,
it hasn't got the teeth that it once had.
I don't want to end before we cover the other big splash, and that's 87.
Yeah.
And I know you've there was a little bit of press attention to that back at the time, and I was wondering if you'd tell me a little bit about what it, you know, did you have a sense that that could happen? Were people saying, you know, something like this may happen? Because you had all your triple witching Fridays and all that stuff.
To your question, John Phelan early on got very concerned about program trading and the program insurance. And we all were very, obviously, I had the same concern that John did. And we talked about it a lot. We had those fellas in who were doing the block trading, the computer trading, and talked to them about it. They didn't want a short selling rule either. And I remember we had a meeting with maybe the 10 biggest computer traders. And they all said, we have the stock, you know, we have these packages. Well, we wondered if they had the packages, and they traded it. And I think John said, well, what if we held you to a short-selling rule on it? We couldn't do it. I'm sitting by the head of one of the big players, and I said to him, could you do it? He said, yeah, we could do it with a short-selling rule. Mm-hmm. And I said, would you stand up and say it, tell him? He said, nope. So we never had it. Mm-hmm. And it was not even close that the program trading absolutely crucified the market. There was one time during the day in 87, I think it was, on that Monday, where the market was with the futures, the market was down, I don't know, 100 points more with the futures than the market was. And so the professionals kept moving more and more interest of money how to do the kind of trading that Bernie Madoff did, not by cheating, but having electronic systems. Mm-hmm. And they got very good at it and very sophisticated at it. They used to, and when Greenwich Capital did the blow up that they had great systems, and they were hypothecating tremendous amounts of money. Well, maybe the commission or someone should make sure that that didn't happen again. And I think they did. They moved. But I have a very uncomfortable feeling that everything we worried about is in that went down the tube is in place to do it again.
Yeah. How long after 87 were you still sort of cleaning up or trying to fix the structure so it wouldn't happen again? Were you working on this for months, years?
Well, in 87, you all this stuff comes out of Chicago. It didn't come out of New York. It came out of the trading and the volatility of the trading in commodities. And that's where the big axes were made. And I recollect we had a meeting with them at the exchange after the crash, and they had one of the fellows who became one of the big players, won the Pulitzer Prize in mathematics or economics, was brought in by Chicago as one of their witnesses. Unfortunately, he hadn't won the prize by that time. He won it about 4 weeks later. And really what these guys would say, hey, listen, these are markets for sophisticated people. We don't deal with the public. Well, now they deal with the public. Yeah. And the sophisticated people are the ones who were doing, they're sophisticated, but the public isn't. And it still goes on.
But you did some things as well, like the circuit breakers, things like that.
Yes, we did.
In the aftermath. And I guess that
worked. But there are no circuit breakers anymore.
Right.
And there's nothing anymore. There's no short selling rule anymore. So the short selling rule, just a simplistic little thing, prevented the kind of wash that we had last year, but it's in place now, and the markets are in place now, and there's no transparency, mm-hmm. and I don't think there ever will be again. So how one can raid a stock could be prevented with the short selling wheel being put back, mm-hmm. if regulators went and took a look and see who sold AIG, who sold the stock right. that knocked Bear Stearns down.
Right.
And there's ways they could do that.
Right. One of the focuses on all this is the whole idea of self-regulation. And, you know, was the New York Stock Exchange successful at self-regulation, or was there always that, you know, the mismatch because you've got the market and the regulators in the same house? And Mike, you've made a big point that, you know, a lot of the self-regulation was really coming out of these committees. It wasn't coming out of the regulation side of the exchange.
Well, the regulation part of the exchange was very supportive of what the committees did, and they had the computers to see who was doing what. And they picked, but we on the floor knew what was happening on the floor. But if someone was trading without orders, for example, that had to be picked upstairs. It couldn't be done by us, and people were found to be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
We would report, we think so-and-so is doing it, but the muscle was upstairs.
Okay, so there were things you could see and things they could see.
Correct.
How important was, or did the regulation side of the exchange become more powerful over time and more influential?
Yes, it became more influential after the crash.
After 87.
And there was no doubt about it. and should have been. And number of specialists lost stocks because they hadn't performed as well as they should have. And that's the ultimate punishment. Taking the bread out, that's the ultimate punishment.
Right. Well, is there anything else that
although the SEC picked up a number of specialists and specialist firms.
Right.
But now that'll never happen again.
Because the floor has it. Right. Well, now they're market makers.
They're no longer specialists. There are no such things.
Yeah. Anything that we haven't talked about that you think it's important to cover here in your career, well, or how the exchange works?
I always thought the exchange would live for 100 more years. We were the exchange was the envy of all other exchanges around the world, and it had credibility. It was an honor to be listed on the New York Stock Exchange. You had to meet criteria that no one else, and there still must be a feeling that the exchange has credibility, or no one would pay listing fees to be there. And my hope is that the exchange will once again have an integrity by regulation that will make it the primary market which it once was. I think I won't be around to see realized, but I always thought it was one of the great national assets, and it is no more as I see it. To mine and many others' great disappointment.
Right.
But thank you for doing this.
Terrific. Thank you.